A year ago, it seemed like everybody and his dog was dumping a bucket of ice over his or her head, challenging friends to either do as they did or donate money to ALS research instead. ALS is amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, Lou Gehrig's disease by his technical name. It became a household name, if it wasn't one already, through the many, many videos of people dousing themselves with ice water last year. There are even blooper reels of ice bucket challenges gone awry. But how about ALS itself? How is it doing in treatment? How is it doing in research? And what other fundraising efforts are going on? For those questions, we have two guests with us. Gail Gallagher is the Care Services Coordinator for the ALS Association, Oregon and Southwest Washington Chapter. She's in the studio with me. Gail, welcome back.
Good morning.
Good to have you here. And Dr. Lou Libby joins us once again from Providence, Portland Medical Center. Welcome back, Dr. Libby.
It's a pleasure to be on.
So, Gail, first of all, there actually was an ice bucket challenge this year, not nearly as big a deal as last year's, apparently, but this is an annual thing now?
Well, that's right. It will be every August. The pledge from the family that started the ALS ice bucket challenge last summer, which ran all summer, decided to continue every August until there's a cure for ALS.
In your years attached to ALS, have you ever seen any fundraiser take off quite the way this one did for ALS or anybody else for that matter?
No, never. And it was a wonderful outcome because so much money was raised for research. We're so thrilled with that.
Dr. Libby, let's talk about the research and what the general thrust of it is these days. And we can back up a little bit later on into what ALS is. But what's the general tenor of research these days and any promise it might be showing?
I think the promise is there. The money has helped immensely, but it takes years and years and years. You know, about $120 million was raised, and 70% of that was earmarked for research by the people who donated the money. And the ALS Association nationally has put out a five-year plan to use that money the way it's been asked to be used by the people who dumped ice on their heads. The exciting things are, there's so many things going on, but I think the most exciting information comes from really basic science research, trying to understand what causes this disease. That's been the tragedy, as one patient said to me yesterday. This is tragic. 75 years ago, Lou Gehrig announced that he had ALS. No one knew what it was, and 75 years later, here we are. We still don't know what causes it, and I'm frustrated. This was a patient, and I said, I'm right there with you. But we're now beginning to get some understanding, and it comes from a couple of different avenues. One is the genetic aspects. 5 to 10% of patients have it in their family. So it's a minority of people, but that gives us a clue. The gene and the abnormalities in the gene that is runs in those families will give us a clue to what's causing it. And then the other whole thing, which goes hand in hand with that, really is understanding what's going on at the cellular basis in the brain and the spinal cord that makes the nerves suddenly die. And that has to do with the way proteins are transmitted from the nucleus of the cell into the cytoplasm of the cell, and a defect in the proteins where they begin to clump and kill the cell. That's a simplistic explanation, but it's very exciting what's happened just in the past year. And of course, the research that's come out in the past year mainly is due to previous funds, and we still have this $115 million that's going to be used appropriately for the benefit of patients and much of it for research. But people have to realize, although $100 million is a ton of money, to get one drug to market that's effective for any disease is usually a $1 to $2 billion effort. So we still need lots more money.
Wow, that is a lot of money.
It's a lot of money.
To get the drug to market. Yep. When you talk about the proteins involved in ALS, amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, there are things that sound similar to processes that happened in Alzheimer's disease, and I wonder if there are any particular synergies that that are found between branches of research for the two diseases.
Well, that's a good question. I'm not an expert on all the research being done in Alzheimer's, but I do know that one of the things that the ALS Association has done with the money that's been raised is try to get researchers together and work collaboratively. They've put together lots of programs and sort of do the seed funding of programs where you get people working in genetics to working with the proteins to working with other neurodegenerative diseases like Alzheimer's or Parkinson's or other diseases where we really do not have a good understanding of the cause. Get those people to work together, and you get a lot more bang for your buck. So we've done a lot of seed money, which means millions, not billions, but millions, to get groups together to work together. They want to work together, but getting people together is difficult and expensive.
Dr. Lou Libby is with the ALS Clinic at Providence Portland Medical Center. We're talking to him about ALS, amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, or Lou Gehrig's disease. Gail Gallagher is with the ALS Association, Oregon and Southwest Washington chapter. She's the care services coordinator. You can join us as we talk about ALS and the prospects for better treatments, for potentially cure, dare we use the word, and for better research down the road. Join us on the exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So do we have figures on what the Ice Bucket Challenge brought in nationally this year?
I believe so far it's about half a million.
Mm-hmm. Which is not chicken feed. I mean, it's not what
no.
you brought in
no,
last year.
No, yeah, put that in context. In a normal August, before the Ice Bucket Challenge, the ALS Association would bring in on the order of $20,000 to $50,000 in donations. So half a million, and that, I think, Gail, was about a week or 10 days ago. So it may end up being closer to a million. But that's great, compared to $20,000 to $50,000. I don't know if I said million, but $20,000 to $50,000 versus half a million, or maybe even up to close to a million, is pretty darn good. But it's never going to be $115 million again.
Gail, how are things organized within the ALS Association? I mean, if money is raised, like through something like the Ice Bucket Challenge that comes in nationally, where does it get distributed between chapters, or, I mean, is the research handled just from national? I mean, do you have any idea about just the basic routing of cash?
Lou may be able to say more about that, but I do know that people who donate were able to designate and request where they wanted the money to go, and so many people did want the money to go to research. In the areas where we have chapters functioning to help people living with ALS, it just so happens that in the summer and into September, that's the time when most chapters have their walks to raise funds and awareness. And so many local people who have loved ones in the area ask that the money they donated go to the walks, which supported the local chapter's services.
And it looks like you have one coming up Sunday after next. Why don't you tell us about that?
We do. On September 13th, Sunday in Bear Creek Park, we have our annual walk for Southern Oregon. And people will gather around 11 o'clock to register and walk at noon and be followed by a pizza party where we celebrate our ALS community. We do have... It just seems every year it grows, and it's a really uplifting experience for the families and the friends of people with ALS. Many of the teams are formed around people that currently live with ALS, but there are also many teams that continue to come back long after a loved one is lost to ALS.
Which is generally going to happen.
Yes.
Correct?
That's right.
All right. Dr. Libby, give us some idea about the prevalence of ALS in the population. I mean, is there a pretty steady percentage? Does it show any increase over time?
It certainly seems that it has increased. I mean, I think that's awareness more than reality. The one population that's especially at risk is the military veterans. Anyone who's been in the military has about double the chance of someone who hasn't been in the military. And it doesn't matter if you were in the Gulf War or Vietnam War or never left the United States. Something about being in the military raises the risk. In general, we have about 400 to 500 people living with ALS at any one time in the state of Oregon, and you can do the statistics on that. But and there is a national registry that's looking in more detail at a lot of things in terms of exactly how many people have it and are living with it, how long they live, what are the risk factors, and I really encourage patients to. Or their families to enter them into that registry, because it's another source of research to try and figure out what are the exposures. Is it head trauma that people have worried about, the concussion thing, which I think is unlikely, but that's being looked at. Is it some sort of toxic exposure that people have? And we're trying to figure all of that out. And it's probably a complex interaction between exposure and some sort of genetic abnormality that brings it out.
All right, but there certainly seems to be a connection to something that happens to you while you are alive, if we're noticing a trend with military veterans in particular.
Yes. Yep. Although that there's a lot of epidemiologic research behind that makes it controversial. But yes, that does seem to be something that happens when we're alive that either brings it out or doesn't bring it out.
Gail Gallagher, since you are Care Services Coordinator, what kinds of care services are provided by the ALS Association's chapter here?
Well, throughout the whole chapter, we have regional care services coordinators, and each one of us is responsible for our community's support. We offer support groups, not only for the people living with ALS, but their loved ones, and also a monthly family caregiver support group. I do home visits, visit with people in their homes so that I can give them kind of a comfortable place to just discuss and ask questions, for the family to gather around and explore what might be coming next, what kinds of interventions, what kinds of lifestyle improvements, and other suggestions that we can make. It's really a sad situation when someone is diagnosed with ALS and is given the message, just go home, get your affairs in order, your life is pretty much going to be ending very soon. And while that may be true, that we don't really always know how long someone's going to survive and live, we do know that quality of life is within the control of most people. And if we are able to provide them with home medical equipment, and we loan actually a lot of devices for communication and other things as well, we can see that people can be more mobile. They can be out in the community rather than stuck at home. They can have methods of communication that will allow them to be in touch with their loved ones and still have their intimate friendship and family connections. There is nothing more devastating than losing the ability to speak. And many of our folks do lose the ability to speak. So mobility, communication, the ability to enjoy what is most meaningful in one's life, those kinds of lifestyle things we really try to help people identify and find ways to achieve.
We were talking about ALS, amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, or Lou Gehrig's disease, and the fundraising for it, including the Ice Bucket Challenge, which there actually was one again this year. You just didn't hear as much about it. Join us on the Jefferson Exchange as we talk further with Gail Gallagher from the ALS Association and Dr. Lou Libby from Providence Portland Medical Center. 800-838-3760, our phone number, our email address, jx@jeffnet.org. Dr. Libby, let's talk about the progression of the disease, because Gail mentioned the whole idea of, you know, go get your affairs in order, because you're going to die very soon. What's the usual rate of things, and how difficult is it to diagnose ALS in the first place?
Two very good questions. ALS is very difficult to diagnose, and almost everyone I meet with ALS, and I meet them after the diagnosis. I'm a pulmonologist, a breathing expert, and I see them when they have breathing problems or questions about breathing, and that's usually not the first symptom. So a neurologist usually makes a diagnosis, but the symptoms start very subtly, and frequently it's a pretty minor thing, like a little weakness in one little finger or very slightly change in the voice, the very subtle things, and you see one doctor and then another doctor. And the disease, to verify the disease, requires two things. It requires manifestations in more than one place on the body, and it requires excluding a whole bunch of other things, everything from a stroke to a brain tumor to a slipped disc. Those sorts of things can imitate some of these things. Toxic things, Lyme disease is sometimes raised as a possibility. So there's lots of different things. So the average person is somewhere between 3 and 12 months between initial irritation of my baby finger doesn't work the way it used to, and they think it's a carpal tunnel syndrome, for example, to the time that they're clearly told, yes, you've got ALS. So, 3 to 12 months, and then from the point where the diagnosis is confirmed, usually by a neurologist, average life expectancy is about 3 to 5 years. But it's quite variable. We see some very unfortunate people who have really rapid onset, rapid progression, and from the diagnosis till death or being placed on a breathing machine full time with a tube in the neck, that sort of thing, can be less than a year. That's rare, probably less than 5% of people. And then there's the other extreme where we have people we've seen with ALS going on 20-plus years. I've got one or two people more than 20 years at this point, and they're still, they may be in a wheelchair, they may have some difficulty with speaking, et cetera, but they're still motoring about and communicating and everything else without the need for support with a ventilator and a hole in the windpipe and that sort of stuff. So it's quite variable, and I suspect some of that has to do with the patient and the attitude and doing the right things, but most of it is, I think, predetermined by the disease process itself.
Well, I was going to ask then if there's been a lot of longitudinal study of the circumstances of people who do live longer versus the ones who live shorter, and if there's any set of distinct factors you can point to say this will generally lead to a somewhat longer pathway.
Well, in general, people who have onset in their legs and arms live longer than those who have onset with their speech and swallow. That's a crude generalization. And about two-thirds of people, the onset is more in the arms and the legs, and one-third it's mainly in the speech and swallow end of things. And the speech and swallow makes it a little more difficult, and they tend to be more, just like Gail said, there's nothing worse than losing your communication ability. But it affects so many other things. That usually goes hand-in-hand with breathing problems. Although everyone eventually gets everything. There's no one who just gets one aspect of it. Everyone gets the arms and legs, and everyone gets the speech and swallow eventually. But it's sort of the onset pattern. So that's one clue. Beyond that, we really don't have good understanding why some people do so great and some people do so terrible. And it's really not that they are doing what the doctor says. I wish I could say that. I think that makes it some difference, but it's not the difference between living a year and living 20 years.
I would like to say, though, that those folks who are able to meet with a pulmonologist like Dr. Libby will have access to non-invasive breathing support. And people do report that they feel better, they feel sharper, they're more alert. And I know Dr. Libby could explain more technically why that helps so much, but that is one intervention that does seem to help people live well.
I agree totally. And they do live longer by formal studies, but we're talking months, not 10 and 20 years longer.
We're talking ALS with Gail Gallagher and Dr. Lou Libby. You can join us on the exchange at 800-838-3760 or jx@jeffnet.org. Boy, when you look at the realm of things out there, it seems like there are almost more things you could figure out that this does not cause ALS versus figuring out what does.
I think you're absolutely right, and they're working on that. That registry is working on it. And I'll tell you the other thing that's important in terms of longevity and quality of life is really what Gail does and our care service coordinators do. And we see patients who live very rich lives, and I think it's because they get involved with other patients with ALS. They stay involved in their families and friends. And it's more of an attitude thing. I don't think they necessarily live a lot longer, but they live better during their time with ALS. And quite a few patients have told me that their life after ALS, in some ways, their relationships with family and friends is stronger than it was before ALS. They take it as a way of connecting with people, and that's so important for quality of life.
Another plus for people in terms of quality of life is being able to connect with an ALS center. A clinic, and up until very recently, Oregon area had to either travel to Portland, where Dr. Libby's clinic is, or to San Francisco. And now we have an ALS clinic happening every month in the Rogue Valley that's headed up by Dr. Eric Lee with the Asante Partners. And this is a great new development. We're very excited to partner with him. The ALS Association is training his team, and so local patients no longer have to drive 5.5 hours to see a clinic, to be a part of a clinic. They can be clinic members or patients locally. Great support.
Speaking of support, I wanted to ask about that because people can get, frankly, a little weird when other people come down with diseases or particularly when they're diagnosed with something potentially terminal. What advice do you have to help friends provide a good supportive environment for somebody with a disease so they don't all get weirded out and leave and just not want to be there because it's too sad for them?
Mm. Wow, that's a complicated question, because in every family you see different kind of constellations of groups. There are some families that are already used to helping out and they're used to receiving help. There are other people and families that don't ever like to have help. They're very rugged individuals. They shun offers of help and kind of isolate. And so I think in my role, that's what I see, because I'm in people's homes every day. And what I try to do is find the strengths in the family and support and answer questions. People with ALS, I think, begin to know what would make their lives richer. Sometimes there's too much help, too much is offered. And so we really have to respect the person living with ALS to give us the guidance about how much help is helpful.
So their communication skills are really key to be able to say, what I need, this is enough.
Don't smother me, don't overwhelm me. But then we have to continue to offer things, because as people's capacities diminish, their needs change. And they begin to realize, I never want to use a walker. But one day they find out, after they've fallen a few times, that the walker is my friend. And so there is this transition that most people make to accepting help and feeling grateful for it.
Dr. Libby, in the minute we have left, can you give us just a general characterization of the feeling within the research community about how things have been going in recent years and where they could go in years to come?
Oh, I think there's an immense excitement about both the boost that the Ice Bucket Challenge money is going to give to research, but also the understanding at the cellular level of what happens with ALS, and that should lead to some treatments that change outcomes.
Gail, quickly tell us again about the Southern Oregon Walk to Defeat ALS.
Sunday, September 13th, Bear Creek Park.
Starting at what time?
11 o'clock.
All right. Gail Gallagher is the Care Services Coordinator for the ALS Association, Oregon and Southwest Washington Chapter. Dr. Lou Libby is with the ALS Clinic at Providence Portland Medical Center. Thank you both for joining us once again on the Jefferson Exchange.
Thank you.
Thank you, Jeff.